In case there's any that's came in or any that's already forgot, we're talking about science in the Bible, talking about scientific facts that are given to us in the Bible that the scientists didn't discover for many years later, and talking, of course, about the fact that the only way that these things could have happened is the fact that they were given to us by the Lord who understands his universe and knows everything about it and was able to reveal those things to us in accordance with his will. So we'd begin at this section talking about the Bible and the atmosphere. And we had talked about the circulation of the atmosphere, and we were talking about the fluid dynamics and the balance of water and air in the earth and how these things were measured out by God. I want to go back and pull one more thing from astronomy that I edited out of the lesson, and I thought about this after I sat down, and I mentioned it briefly in the introduction of the lesson, but I want to go ahead and point this out. In Psalms 19, verses 4 through 6, and then I think we'll be done with the astronomy stuff. But again, this I think is very worth us mentioning since we have a little bit of extra time to deal with these things in these lessons. In them has he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices as a strong man to run a race. His, that is the sun's, his going forth is from the end of the heaven and the circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. This, of course, indicates that the sun is moving through space, that it's the coming is from the end of heaven and his circuit unto the ends of it. Well, as I said, when I was in school, the common assumption was that the sun was the center of everything and it just stayed right where it was. And it wasn't until much later that it was discovered that our whole galaxy was moving through space. So it was, and this was a long-held belief, even after things were discovered that it all hung there in the earth and all of those discoveries, they still believed that the sun was stationary. And so this verse would not have made sense to people from a perspective of science when they read this and saw that the science circuit is from one end of the heaven and is circuit unto the ends of it. Well, the current belief in science today is that the sun is in fact moving through space, the sun moving at about 600,000 miles per hour, as a matter of fact, literally flying through space. Traveling at that speed, the circuit of the sun is so great that it would take approximately 200 million years to create one pass of the sun on this circuit, aptly described as from one end of the heavens to the other end of the heavens. The great vastness of the distance of the orbit of the sun, orbiting around who knows what. The Bible doesn't tell us, and science hasn't figured it out either. But very interesting to see that the Bible talks about the sun moving through space in Psalms years below, before there was any concept of that happening in science. On with the Bible and the atmosphere. And I put this under atmosphere. I don't know if that's where it belongs or not. But I believe, as we talked about a little bit earlier, the circuits of the atmosphere and things, I believe, are primarily responsible for this. But we're going to talk about the paths of the seas. And you've probably heard about this. This is one of the more famous of these things that science discovered. And the reason that this is more famous than perhaps any of the others, the person who discovered the Gulf Stream and the other aspects of the currents of the ocean actually claims that he got his information that he used to discover that from the Bible. So he actually attributes the fact that his scientific discovery was made possible by what he read in the Bible. So that's very interesting. But Psalms chapter 8 and verse 8 says, "The fowl of the air and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas." So it's a little tongue twister there. But we have the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea passing through the paths of the sea. Now, of course, doesn't make very much sense to think about birds passing through the paths of the sea, unless, of course, you understand that this is part of the atmosphere, circuits of the atmosphere, circuits of the wind that creates this phenomenon that causes the paths of the seas. I believe as well it's probably, again, the influence of the moon and stars and planets and all of that on Earth, as we had read a little bit earlier. But this, of course, given to us in the Bible, mentioning paths of the sea, and it was not until the mid-19th century that any connection was made regarding ocean currents, literally paths in the sea. And in 1860, oceanographer Matthew Fontaine Maury, M-A-U-R-Y, called attention to the fact that the ocean was a circulating system, and he showed consistent existence of paths in the ocean. And, of course, began to show how they could be predicted and you could know where they were and that kind of thing. And his book on physical oceanography is still a highly regarded source of information on the science. And he has attributed the fact that he discovered the paths in the seas to the fact that he read about them in the Bible. So he thought that there would be predictable currents in the ocean that one could find that would travel these circuits. And, of course, he thought that would be helpful in us learning to navigate the seas, which is exactly what happened. And now we use those currents to get from one continent to another and much more economically and efficiently, cutting the time and all of that. And the Gulf Stream, which flows from the east coast of North America towards Europe, is about 50 miles wide and 3,000 feet deep. So it's quite a path in the ocean and unknown to man. Excuse me. Really unknown and undiscovered to man until 1860. I'm sure that people stumbled across it and wondered what was going on, but to find it and to predict where it was and understand that it was a predictable circuit did not happen until much later. And as we look at the size of the Gulf Stream, 50 miles wide, 3,000 feet deep, its rate of flow measured in volumes per second is about 1,000 times greater than the Mississippi River. And we think about how big the Mississippi River is and how the massive amount of water it dumps into the Gulf. And the Gulf Stream is carrying 1,000 times that amount of water. And, of course, ocean vessels try to get in that current and ride it in order to save shipping time, save fuel, and all of that. So you can look in Psalms chapter 8. You can underline that paths of the sea and say confirmed by Matthew Maury in 1860. Again, we see the accuracy of God's word and something that later was discovered and even given credit to the Bible for helping him to discover those currents. I don't know that all that's true, but that at least is his account of those things, and it's a highly considered thought. And it's the only one that I have seen that actually attributes the scientific discovery to the Bible. I wonder how many others that was the case. Because if people said, well, you know, I was reading about paths in the sea and the Bible, and I think I'm going to go look for them. What do you think people would have thought at the time? You know, they would have thought the person was crazy. Much as, you know, when we hear about evolution and about billions of years and all of that kind of stuff, when we say, well, I don't really believe that, of course, we're considered to be small-minded, to be ignorant, and the fact that, you know, we have a faith position because we believe the Bible. When none of those things have been proven by science. Using their own scientific method, they cannot prove evolution or billions of years ago. Because remember what we talked about in the definition of science? It's using your five senses in the present world, using repeatable tests to confirm things. Of course, none of that's happened with evolution. If you turned in a science project and you said, I want to prove this, and you went through it and you couldn't prove it, you had the same amount of evidence that the scientist has for evolution, and you turned in that science project, you would fail because you did not use the scientific process to prove your hypothesis. And that is a fact. And yet, science would tell us that's a fact position. Our belief in the Bible, that's a faith position. But I believe that they're both faith positions. And as we said earlier, the question is, who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe fallible man? Are you going to believe infallible God? Now, very interesting is the fact that the Bible talks about hydrology, or the water cycle. I think it was Larson, when they were here, we were talking about education and things, and he said, well, the one thing I know I learned from school is the water cycle, because every year from the time I started school until now, every year they start talking about the water cycle. So he says, I've got that figured out pretty good. And you know, science continues to teach us about the water cycle because it's so important to us. But you know, the Bible speaks about the water cycle long before man even understood what was going on with it. The oldest reference, again, Job being one of the older books in the Bible, Job chapter 36, verses 27 through 29. And look at the description of the water cycle here. He maketh small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly. Also, can any understand the spreadings of the clouds or the noise of his tabernacle? Well, I don't know if anybody else just finds it amazing, but for it to talk about water in these terms, he makes small the drops of water. They pour down according to the vapor. So he's literally talking about water vapor, decreasing the size of the water down to the water vapor, and then the clouds distilling it and dropping it back down on man abundantly. Now, I don't know if you find that absolutely astonishing, but I just find that astonishing that the Bible so accurately describes what happens with water and did it 6,000 years ago when, you know, we had so little knowledge of anything about science as we know it at that time. Now, the talk of the water cycle and things became prominent in the Bible. About in the 16th century, so that'd be the 1500s, is when they really first started to write and talk about the water cycle as a fact of science. Let's look at a couple of the other verses that talk about the water cycle. Again, I find this really amazing. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 13. When he uttereth his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens, and he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth, and he makes lightnings with rain and brings forth the wind out of his treasuries. So again, the understanding here is that he causes the water vapor to ascend to the heavens, and then he makes the lightnings with the rain. So he makes the conditions right for the rain to happen. Again, as Job put it, to distill the waters, pour them down abundantly on man. Clearly references to what we understand to be the water cycle now, the evaporation, the distillation in the clouds, the condensing, and the falling back to earth. And remember, all of this within that balance that we talked about, the weight of the air, the weight of the water, the amount of water measured out in the hollow of God's hand, and all that has to be in balance in order for us to sustain the life, the sea life, the animal life, the plant life. All of that has to be in the right proportion. And yet science now would have us to believe that it's a coincidence. All that just happened. The right amount of water got here. Right amount of it's in water vapor, right amount of it's in water. It was all random sequence of events that led to that. Well, who are you going to believe? Then we're going to talk about the Bible and geology, but once again, I have one more thing I want to talk about on the other subject, the thought about the hydrology, the water cycle, and the flowing of the rivers into the Gulf, into the ocean. This is something that used to just amaze me as a kid. I remember seeing where water would just dump into the ocean or into the Gulf, and it would never fill up. And, you know, that's amazing to think about that happening. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 7, it says, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. So here it's literally telling us that as the river, which came about how? It came about by the rain causing the river to flow down towards the ocean. It empties into the ocean and it goes back to the clouds where it came from. And it's just amazing to think as you watch that Mississippi River dump into the Gulf. And it's, I looked this and I had it, but I thumbed through here and I can't find where I wrote it. But it's, I believe it's to the tune of 1 million gallons a second. It might be a minute, but either one's pretty phenomenal to me. But that amount of water dumping into the Gulf, and you think that it's evaporating that fast, that it never fills the sea up, never fills the ocean up. Astonishing. But again, it's all about the balance. And that's, I believe, why God told us about it. He told us, you know, that about the water turning into vapor, distilling into clouds, dumping down water upon us, doing it all in the measure of His hand, so that we can see the majesty of God. We can see that He made us, He made this world, and He did all of these things in just the right proportion. If it didn't evaporate fast enough, the ocean would fill up. If it evaporated too fast, it would dry out. I mean, it's just amazing that all of these things happen just the way they need to happen. And we're led to believe by science that we should just take it on faith. That's my terms, that we've got it figured out. The earth started as this molten blob, and you know, certain things happened, and there was this primordial soup, and lightning flashed through it, and there came life, and all these things just happened. And all of a sudden we had the world in which we now live. And I'll tell you what, if you can believe that, it takes a lot more faith than it takes to believe the Bible. I don't have enough faith to believe all of those random chance events can happen. I've seen how 1,000,000 to 1 things just don't happen. And these are billions and billions of millions to one odds of these things, even one of them happening, let alone all of them chaining together in a way that would create the earth. Impossible. And it is a faith position. And don't let science tell you that's a fact. It's a faith position. The Bible tells us about the water cycle. It tells us that it had to be put here in the right measure, and that's what God did. The Bible told us about it thousands of years before science ever discovered it. Now let's look at Bible and geology. And the first thought we want to look at there is what exists beneath the crust of the earth. And you know, as we talked about the stars and people looking up into the stars, I think there was a lot of fascination about what's below the earth. And you know, we have books that are written about it. We have a lot of fantasizing about what might be on the center of the earth. And that's been the case for a long time. We've had a lot of very old writings about speculation as to what was in the center of the earth. Of course, the oldest of those writings just thought it was a big rock in the middle of the earth. And actually, that was a scientific point and part of how it was created. And it wasn't until much later that man started to think that there was a fire in the center of the earth, because he could see volcanoes and see fire coming out of volcanoes, and he made the connection. Wow, there must be fire in the center of the earth, because that's what happens when a volcano erupts. It comes from down under the ground. But man could have looked at Job chapter 28 and verse 5. It says, as for the earth, out of it cometh bread. Under it is turned up, as it were, fire. So we see that a description of Job of the inside of the earth, that under the crust of the earth, there is fire. And it doesn't just say there was fire. It says, as it were fire. And isn't that a good description of what we now understand lava to be? It's burning, but it's not an actual fire, but it's like a fire, and it incorporates fire into it. So that's what the center of our earth is made up of. And Job told us 6,000 years ago, under the earth was fire. R.D. Oldham is given credit for discovering the core in 1906, that the core was fire, basically molten material. And it was actually after that that the mantle was discovered, which I found very interesting. And this is a foreign name. I'm not even going to try. But it was somewhere around 1909, the distinction was made between the core of the earth and the mantle of the earth, and the differences in the composition and that kind of thing. The Bible told us 6,000 years before they discovered it. Newton, in the 1700s, had speculated that there was fire in the center of the earth. I guess he never got any traction, because he had no proof of, and never did the experiments and things to prove it, but he had actually written that he believed the center of the earth to be fire. Job wrote about it thousands of years earlier. Truly, our God is an awesome God. The thickness of the crust of the earth. Now, this is very interesting. Did you know that we don't really know how thick the crust of the earth is? We have all kinds of guesses, but there's a reason that we don't have an actual depth of the crust of the earth. It's because we've never been able to penetrate the barrier between the crust of the earth and the mantle. There's been numerous attempts. Every attempt has been unsuccessful to measure the actual thickness of the crust of the earth and to reach through to the mantle. So much of what we know is still speculation. Jeremiah 31 and 37 says, thus saith the Lord, if the heavens above can be measured, and look at this, we read this verse earlier, but if the foundations of the earth can be searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they've done it, saith the Lord. So we see here, we talked about how he said if the heavens above can be measured, he was saying, really, you can't measure the heavens. And he's saying you can't search out the earth beneath, which I believe that man will never fully understand what's beneath the surface of the earth. Why? Because Jeremiah said it in the Bible. And I believe that's why our efforts have been thwarted in trying to discover this. And they've said that there's an impenetrable barrier between the crust and the mantle of the earth. They know a lot about it. How do they know so much about it? Because the volcanoes do issue forth from the mantle of the earth. So they understand a lot about its composition. They understand what's there. And that, of course, has broken through this barrier. And so while they might be able to approach the mantle of the earth in that way, they're not going to be able to search it out from the surface of the earth, because the Bible says that they can't search out the foundations beneath the earth. I don't know if that means they'll never be able to measure how thick the crust actually is. I don't know if it means they'll never ever be able to drill into it, but I know this, they will never be able to search out the earth beneath, and we'll never know assuredly what that is, because the Bible said it. Science thinks they've figured it out, and I'm sure they know an awful lot about it. And it stands to reason that they have a pretty good idea what it is because of the volcanoes and the eruptions. The crust is estimated to be between 7 and 35 kilometers thick. Evidently, they believe it to be thinner in some places and thicker in other places. I don't know if that's the truth. I don't know if that's actual based on good science or not. But it's probably based on how far they've drilled down until they were unsuccessful going any further. So they figure that's about how thick it is in that place. And Jeremiah said, you can't search out the foundations of the earth beneath. So I'm sure they'll continue to try. And I don't think we'll ever fully understand that. Because when it comes to believing science or man, or the Bible, we need to believe the Bible. The Bible says they can't search out the foundations of the earth beneath. But it's very interesting as you look at the makeup of the earth and the amount of time that's been spent to discover that. And of course, there is a lot of information about that. But they've never been able to successfully drill through the core. And how about the existence of hydrothermal vents or springs in the sea? Well, science discovered these not too awful long ago, 1977, I think, was the most significant discovery of the hydrothermal vents. Well, now, of course, these hydrothermal vents are believed to be where life generated because they had the heat and the chemicals and the water and all of that. So it was probably in these hydrothermal vents or springs of the sea that life generated. Well, they weren't really discovered until, as we said, 1977. They were discovered along the Galapagos Rift. Many of these hydrothermal vents exist very, very deeply in the ocean, places that we've yet barely been able to see. So that's what took so long for them to establish even robots that can go down and withstand the water pressures at those depths. But in Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were open. I'm not sure if that refers to the hydrothermal vents there, but I think it does indicate the water that existed below the earth and a source of the water that came about as the flood. But look at Job 38 and 16. Job 38 and 16 says, hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or hast thou walked in search of the depth? And from what I read, and I don't know, again, the accuracy of it, but I believe that there's still places on the floor of the ocean that we've been unable to go. There's certain areas that are so deep that we have been unable to go to them. We have estimates as to how deep they are. But it talks about the mountains of the earth. And this is something I edited out, but it belongs well here in Jonah chapter 2 and verse 6. It says, I went down to the bottoms of the mountains. The earth with her bars was about me forever. Yet have you brought up my life from corruption, O Lord my God. And this was talking about he was in the depths. So, and talking about going to the bottom of the mountains. So it's believed that that was a reference to the mountains that are in the ocean. And some of the mountains and the clefts and that are in the ocean, we still, this many years later, have been unable to go all the way to the bottom of those. And it's talking in Job 38:16, have you walked in search of the depth? God knows the depth of the ocean. He knows what's in those crevices. He knows exactly how deep it is, how tall the mountains are. He knows that there was mountains in the earth. It was not until more recently that we discovered the fact that the bottom of the ocean has mountains. And some mountains that are very, very tall. I believe some mountains that are higher than the tallest mountain on earth. The tallest mountain of all is in the ocean. And it's amazing that the Bible speaks of those things. Science didn't speak about those until many, many years later. So we think of the hydrothermal vents discovered as early as 1977. The Bible talked about them years ago. Another thing I had edited out, so I don't have here concerning geology, comes from Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 7 through 9. It says, God bringeth thou into a good land, out of whose hills thou mightest dig brass. And this was something that's been scoffed at. Fortunately, I will say this came from Brandy's science book. So, of course, there are some good science books that don't assume billions of years and don't assume evolution. The Creation Museum has a science curriculum, and also Bob Jones University has a science curriculum that gives you the scientific facts and tells you about all of the existence of all of these things, but it does it from a Bible perspective. And it pointed out the fact that in this land, and I forgot I didn't write down all the exact location of this because I thought I was going to not use it. But they went to these hills in 1957. There was a lot of speculation and a lot of people scoffing at the fact that the Bible said there was brass that could be made in this land. And, you know, that comes from smelting copper. And so they were looking for copper in these hills. And in 1957... they found copper mines, and as they unearthed these copper mines, they found big pits that they had believed now they had smelted the copper into brass. And so the Bible, again, where science scoffed at it and said, there is no copper in these hills. Well, there was copper in those hills, and there's now scientific and archaeological evidence that the copper was taken out of those hills and brass was made out of it, just as the Bible said. Man didn't figure it out till 1957. The Bible talked about it in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 7 through 9. So again, even in the geology of the earth, there's other things in the earth that the Bible talks about that have been borne out. It would take a long time to go through all these. We'll go through this, and then we'll stop at this point and pick it up again this evening. But of course, the most obvious, the one that everybody thinks about when you think about Bible evidences, is the fact that the earth is round. And I put it in geology just because it's about the earth, and I guess it could have gone in astronomy as well. But Isaiah 40 and 22 says, it is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. So again, we can see a couple things here. The word that's translated circle here is the Hebrew word chuwg, which is also translated as a circuit or a compass, depending on the contents. It always indicates something spherical, rounded, or arched, never something that's flat or square. So the word that's used here was definitely being used to indicate spherical, circular, the nature of the earth, that he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth. Isaiah was written between 680 B.C. and 740 B.C., and that would be 300 years before Aristotle first suggested that the earth might be a sphere in his book On the Heavens. So I was again surprised that as early as 380 B.C., Aristotle wrote that he had speculated that the earth was round. Of course, he was ridiculed for that belief. And, of course, we know the history as Columbus came to America based on his belief that the earth was circular. And of course, many people thought that he would perish in that effort because he would sail off the end of the world. And that was a belief that was held for, you know, a long time, that the earth was flat and that one would either be eaten by some kind of monster or fall into the abyss or whirlpools. I've heard all kinds of suggestions as to what existed at the end of the ocean. But also we see in this thought that it talks about the heavens spreading out. And I don't know if that's an indication to the ever-spreading nature of the heavens or not, but again, it's a potential reference to that, that the universe is expanding, that it continues to unfold. And that's not evolution. That's not the result of some random act. If it is doing that, it's because God designed it to do that. And that was God's will for it. And the Bible tells us about it doing it. So I imagine God knew that it was doing that, and it does it for a reason. We may not know the reason. We may not have a full understanding. But we know that the Bible tells us about those things thousands of years before science. And it's just amazing as we look at just fact after fact that the earth, that the Bible tells us about the earth and that scientists didn't understand. So we'll go ahead and cut off with this. As you can see there, we're going to deal with the Bible and biology because there's just many, many things in the Bible that tell us that we can use biological, medical, all kinds of facts that the Bible gives us about our human bodies that science didn't discover until much later. So we'll try to, I'll try to get some of these incorporated a little better. I wound up having to jump around because I started putting stuff back in that I'd already taken out. So I apologize if I wasn't real smooth in those transitions. But, and again, I don't have all of this information. There is, I'm sure, that as you look at many different things, and as our understanding of science continues to develop, I believe we'll find more and more of these things that the Bible pointed out, and the Bible had right, and science has had wrong for thousands of years. And it's important for us to understand that. And the young people that are just daily just pounded on about billions of years and about evolution, you need to have the courage to understand that the Bible pointed out all of these things years before science, proved science wrong time and again. Now, it may not happen in your lifetime, certainly may not happen in my lifetime, but I'll tell you what, as time goes on, it is going to be proven aspects of evolution, if not evolution as a whole, is false. And if you go back to Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species, which was what launched this whole evolution thing, almost every point that he used in that book has either been admitted to be falsified or proven to be false. And still, people have not said, okay, evolution is not true. They've just changed what they believe about it. And that's what happens when it comes to science. Science is an ever-changing thing. The Word of God is constant. It's fixed. And it said things 6,000 years ago, 6,000 years before science discovered them, pointed out scientific facts. And the question becomes, who are you going to believe? And you know, if you can't believe God about the creation, and you can't believe God about all the things that we read about in the Bible, then you can't have sufficient faith to believe His plan of salvation. And that's why I think it's so important to root ourselves and ground ourselves in the understanding that the earth was created in 6 literal days, 24-hour days, that God created the heavens and the earth. God created all of the animal life. It reproduces after its own kind, just as the Bible said. We may see some natural selection. We may see some changes within a species, but we will never see interspecies evolution. We need to be able to believe that. We need to have the confidence to believe that. And as we look at all of these positions, and you can think about being a person and saying, you know, well, there's springs in the seas, or, you know, the heavens. You'll never be able to measure the heavens because they're always expanding. Or if you said, you can't count the stars in heaven, science was there to prove you wrong all the way down through history. But they've never been able to do it. The Bible has always proved them wrong. And it'll be that way as long as time stands. Where the Bible and science conflict, the Bible is going to be proved to be right. And God, the same God that created us, the same God that placed us in this world with just this right balance to allow us to live, has given us a plan not only to live here, but to live with Him eternally in heaven. He's given us a wonderful opportunity to go and to be with him. We've seen what an awesome God he is and what a thought it is to dwell with him eternally in heaven. If you've never obeyed his plan of salvation, you need to do that. He's told us to hear, believe, repent, change our will to do his will, publicly confess our belief in him as the Son of God, to be buried with him in baptism, to rise and walk in newness of life, to live faithful unto death, that heaven might be our home, and we might share that home with the awesome God that we've thought about this morning. If you'd be subject to that gospel call in any way, won't you come while we stand and sing the song that's been selected?